And why has the data not been shared?
No, they didn't isolate the virus. That's the issue.
No, they didn't isolate the virus. That's the issue.
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I have a special returning guest here to discuss some very contentious topics. For that exact purpose is why we're having this conversation today. As many of you have come to see, I'm quite frustrated with the odd kind of polarized discussion with everything politically oriented in this country and everywhere else, it seems, but specifically around COVID-19, because you guys know that I pride myself on this show about being objective, about being able to entertain thoughts without fully accepting them, which used to be called a sign of intelligence. So today, and just set the record right off the bat, these discussions are something in regard to the isolation of COVID, of SARS-CoV-2, the terrain theory discussion. These are things that I find very interesting. And in particular, the isolation discussion. There's a lot that seems to suggest that it has not been isolated. It has not met Koch's postulates, but I'm open to either side of this discussion, which some people just can't seem to wrap their mind around. So today, joining me yet again is somebody who is very educated on this topic and is backing up what he's saying with science, facts, and evidence, which we're supposed to be doing, and that is Dr. Andrew Kaufman. Thank you again for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It's really a pleasure to be back here.
Yeah, it's always good to have you on because I think this, I mean, again, just for that first point, just showing people that we're able to have an open-minded discussion about things is just, it's rare today. You know, it just doesn't exist. And that seems so incredible to me. I just can't get past that. But so today we want to get into, for those that haven't seen, I've had Andrew on before in the past to discuss the original point when this was first coming up and it was being, you know, contradicted and challenged but it's really kind of fleshed out a lot, I would say, since that point. You know, there's a lot of very highly credentialed, highly respected people that are coming out and saying that what you're saying is correct, and as well as the discussion of the terrain theory itself and what that really means. And so those are two very different things. So why don't we actually start off today with the difference between two different things so people understand this? And one would be the difference between saying that something hasn't been isolated in regard to a virus versus not satisfying Koch's postulates, because those are two different things, right? There's, you know that, but there's different things within that need to be met. And you could even argue that something has been isolated, which I know you disagree with in general, but still hasn't met Koch's postulates, which I think is interesting. But then the discussion of terrain theory itself and what that means, much larger than just isolating a virus, but more so that this whole thing is something we're misunderstanding. So how are you today, first of all?
I'm doing really well. And yes, you are definitely challenging me here with answering some big questions, but no problem. I'll be happy to take a crack at it. And, like the quote from Dr. Zhenzhu in the introduction, this really is the issue. Because everything rests upon this issue. And so we can certainly talk about terrain theory and a new paradigm of health and healing, but that is a different discussion, and I'm glad that you make the distinction. Because the primary thing that we're talking about with virus isolation and Koch's postulates is really related to something that Carl Sagan said, which is extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. So in other words, what I'm talking about is the claim that there is a invisible particle, right, that's on the scale of billionth of a meter in size, but we can't see it. It's invisible really to almost everyone except under the electron microscope, and that this tiny particle has caused all of the death and destruction that has come in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is an extraordinary claim. And I sought out to look at what is the proof or the evidence of this claim. And what I learned is that the experiments that they've done in virology actually are not even possible, not only to prove any causation of an illness, but actually not even possible to prove the existence of these virus particles that they're claiming are SARS-CoV-2 and other agents of disease.
And this is the crux of the issue for me, is this contradiction, or this just disagreement, that makes it sound like it's honest. I think it's not, but between the word itself and what it means. And this is what, I mean, we can get right into this first part of it, because this is something that actually, the whole reason why I wanted to speak with you again today was a recent discussion that I saw between you and Dr. Mikovits on a round table. And it comes down to this idea between what she continues to say was something that was isolated in regard to HIV. But when you really get down to it, and I'll include the link in the show, it comes down to her saying, well, no, it was just budding from the culture. And you go, well, there you go, right? That's not what we're talking about. So what's the disconnect there? Why is it that they're saying that's isolated when it's clear that it's not even meeting that basic definition?
Right. Well, there is an inherent contradiction. And just to, you know, back away from the specific elements of, you know, of particles and budding and cells and that kind of thing for a second, and just think, you know, common sense. If you want to say that there's a new organism that exists, right, and it's functioning in some way in the world, well, in order to show that that organism actually, it does exist, right, that it's a real thing, you have to have it, right? You have to be able to take it from some source in nature and separate it from the other things so that you can show what it is, and then you can study it. You know, just like if you were an explorer going into the jungle and looking for, you know, new species of jungle cats, right? If you found one, you would that was different from the other ones, you would take a specimen and bring it back to the laboratory so that you could study it. So that's required in order to identify a new organism, especially one that's never been characterized before. So we don't know anything about it. So we can't, you know, like find clues. Like, for example, if you're a detective and you want to, you know, find someone, you might use fingerprints, but the fingerprints are only useful if you actually know the person who they belong to. So you have to have that foreknowledge. But if you were, you know, going out looking for something that's never been characterized, you would have to find it in its intact form in order to describe it in the first place. And that's what has not been done. So, of course, the common way to describe that would be to take that virus organism and isolate it, right? Separate it from everything else. Well, the viral scientists or virologists who study viruses, they write all these papers where they say a novel virus has been isolated. However, they don't mean that. They mean something totally different. And this has really been corrupted based on a paper written in 1954 by John Enders, who later won the Nobel Prize in medicine, I believe. And this then became, you know, sort of some kind of a standard of proof that these particles exist. But if you actually look at the experiment yourself, you'll see that it couldn't possibly show that, because it misses the whole point. All they can say is that they're showing you dead and dying cells in a culture, but they really have no way to tell that there's anything like a virus in there. They would have to, you know, really show that it exists first. And then they could maybe find clues that say, okay, we can identify this thing that we already know that exists. But they skip that step. They never actually show that it's a real thing.
So what's their logic for doing so? Are they just acting like they did it and not saying that? Or are they saying, here's why we skipped it and here's the justification? What's the logic there?
Well, I think what many of the people who are doing this now believe is that some scientist in the past validated this experiment and showed that it actually correlates to the real thing in some way. And they've been given a license to use this. And you know, if you're a virologist, like if you go and look in the literature, you can just find hundreds of papers where they have new viruses and animals, you know, like bats and such. In fact, they found a SARS-like bat, a virus in bats that is exactly the same story as the SARS-CoV-2 back in 2011. You can find a paper. Okay. So it's like, you know, how many papers can you get out of it? Then you get those papers published and then you get more grants and it keeps your career going. So, This is why the method persists.
That's an important point right there. Just on a side note for people to remember is that to the question of like, how can this, you know, taking what you're saying at face value, how could this happen? That's why, right? There's funding, there's a hierarchy involved. And if you create a system where people, no matter how good their science is, won't get something published unless they meet certain criteria, well, then they're going to find that they need to meet that criteria, whatever that criteria may be, you know, and that's what's happening. Same thing with a lot of other power structures in a lot of governments, but this country in particular. And so it's easy to see how they can develop that with people in certain positions that are driving a certain agenda.
And, you know, the people who are in that field who realize that it's not real science, they would just leave. Right. So like, I mean, I only know one example like that, Stefan Lanka, who is a virologist in Germany. And once he discovered this and he tried to talk to his professors, but of course they shunned him and he ended up, you know, with a career change. And just like for me, you know, in medicine, like once I realized the truth about healthcare, I couldn't keep practicing. So I had to change my career and, you know, figure out a different way.
Which from my perspective and from a lot of people in my field, it's a very respectable thing to do, because if you're honest about the health profession, you're violating the Hippocratic Oath every day, the way that this country practices our healthcare system, you know, and that's so frustrating. So it's time to take a stand against stuff like this. So it's, you know, that's very commendable. But coming into the idea of the difference between these things and taking it into the concept of Koch's postulates, there's a contradiction even within these in every step, right? Because at one point we're saying, no, they've done what they're supposed to do. And then you actually go into it, and here's the actual breakdown of you know, what they're supposed to meet. You could, the argument I have is that they're not meeting all four of them. So you could argue maybe they did isolate it in step one, but the fact that needs to be re-isolated from another inoculated disease experimental host, that's even based on their own publications, that's not happening, which I find very telling.
But Ryan, so there's a couple of things in here, because they actually haven't fulfilled any of them. And I don't think you could even make an argument that they have, because look at the first one. Based on all of the testing and cases that they've defined, they're saying that it's in healthy organisms. So that right there violates the first postulate. Right. And now also, if it's supposed to be found in abundance in organisms suffering from the disease, why can't they simply purify it out of a person with the disease? Why do they have to add it to a tissue culture? They say that they don't have enough of it to find, right? But that doesn't make sense if it's abundant, because it's actually supposedly culturing in the person with the illness. So it could be abundant.
And to add right there as well, the point is that just because they say they can't find it enough, that doesn't change. You don't get to say, well, we met it, except here's the caveat. Like, that's what frustrates me about it. So there's not an, even if you take their argument at face value, that still means by definition, they haven't met Koch's postulates. You see it. And this is the dilemma for me, is that they're continuing to argue it. But then when you really press into what you're saying here, And you expose that in a conversation, the final outcome is, well, Koch's postulates is outdated anyway, I know, blah, 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 which it's just kind of this roundabout logic, you know? And so there's an obvious disconnect there. Well, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the, you know, Tom Cowan and Sally Fallon and I put up a statement on virus isolation to help clarify these issues, because we do get, you know, just hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of inquiries of people saying, you know, yes, the virus is isolated. Here's a paper with it right in the title and things like this. And we wanted to kind of clarify what we mean in reality, that we don't mean tissue culture experiments. We mean it was actually taken from a person, you know, who is ill and shown in a pure form, like they've done with bacteriophages, you know, which are what they say are viruses that live among bacteria. They can do it, no problem there. You can find old, you know, lab textbooks from the 40s and 50s that describe how to purify these particles out of a clinical sample. They've done it with exosomes. It's maybe, you know, like not something that you do in one day in the lab, but over a period of a few weeks, it's been done so many times. If there are particles there, they should be able to show them. It's quite simple. Now, they have actually published two papers that I'm aware of where they claim that this new virus that they haven't actually shown satisfies Koch's postulates. But these articles are completely fraudulent, because they don't actually follow any step, even the ones that they outline. And I did an analysis of one of these papers with Sayer G a while back about transgenic mice. But even if you say that they isolated the virus and they inoculated these mice, none of the mice developed the symptoms or autopsy findings of COVID-19. So, so basically what they did was they gave them a toxic cell culture and it caused toxicity to their bodies, but in a non-specific manner, right? And then they said, oh, this proves Koch's postulates. And, you know, it's preposterous. And all of this really boils down to what Professor Ioannidis from Stanford University wrote about in 2005 in PLOS-1, which is that more than half of all published research findings are false. Mm-hmm. So that, and I'll tell you that all of the virology papers are in that false half.
I've written, it's been an old writer of ours wrote about something called p-hacking, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And the idea that it's another concept we were just sort of touching on, that you can, you'll find what you want to find. Obviously you can mix up the results 100 times over until you sort of get something that you can use. And it's the same kind of concept. And that's, I argue, one of the reasons that discussion's being had, that a lot of this science is just being driven or, you know, fraudulent for a large degree. And I mean, the examples we're setting out right now are obvious, that they're just not meeting the basic kind of idea that we're getting into. But I want to bring it back to this discussion on this roundtable you had in regard to I could actually play the clip if that's necessary, but the idea of the budding culture and versus isolation. And what frustrates me about this back and forth is that one, Dr. Mikovits, who I've had on more than once, and I respect her, has a argument that it is isolated and that you guys agree. And yet then you're saying, well, we don't agree though. And it's, and I think it's quite clear, to be honest, watching this back and forth, that what you're saying is that it's not isolated. And she's saying, but it is isolated. It's budding out of the culture. And you say, well, that's not isolated. So could you explain that for people and explain maybe why this is why they continue to say it's isolated, even though it doesn't actually meet the definition?
Absolutely. And, you know, let me also say that I also have a lot of respect for Dr. Mikovits. And, you know, she's done a great service for our country. And I was just trying to clarify some scientific points, because in my opinion, she seems to contradict herself. Mm-hmm. And it's about this very issue. So she says that she agrees with me that there's never been an isolation of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which, you know, the alleged to cause COVID-19. But she says by the same procedure that they claim to isolate the SARS-CoV-2, that she, in collaboration with some other scientists, did isolate HIV virus, and that one is different somehow, that it can't actually be separated from the cells, and that it's only can be seen budding. Now, this doesn't really make sense with how they say viruses spread from cell to cell and person to person, which is by budding off and then being intact particles separate from the cell, and then, you know, going through someone's semen or saliva into another person, right? That's how they say it's transmitted. So if it can't separate from the cell, it can't do that, because our cells don't break off and go into other people.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. So that's what I was trying to get her to explain. But really what it amounts to is, I believe that, you know, virologists take credit for things that they didn't actually do. And this process of budding in and out of the cell, if anyone who's taken, you know, college level biology, just the introductory course, you would have learned about two processes called exocytosis and endocytosis. And these are where little vesicles bud out of the cell to send things out into the milieu, and other little vesicles actually come in to our cells and like invaginate the membrane and empty their contents in, and that's called endocytosis. And this is how cells communicate with other cells by sending, you know, materials and information back and forth. And so this is a common process universal to all cells. And if we see that under a microscope, how do we know that what we're seeing is anything different from run-of-the-mill exocytosis or endocytosis? There's nothing distinctive that says that, oh, this particle budding out is actually a virus that's killing our cells. Where's the evidence of that? You know, in order to show that, you would have to, if you could purify out those particles by themselves and then put them in an animal and then show the animal to get immune deficiency, well, then you'd say, oh, well, this does cause AIDS. But that has never been done, and it can't be done because as Judy even said, they can't actually separate out the particles. But I say that the only scientific conclusion that you can make based on the inability to isolate or purify particles is those particles don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, see, and this gets into the issue of so people could make an argument that they haven't been isolated yet viruses exist, right? And this is where we jump into a different conversation, which I want to get into.
Sorry, but that would be equivalent to me saying that Martian space dust causes colds and flu, because there's no evidence to support that. It's just my contention, right? And if you're talking about the cause of a disease, which has serious real world consequences right now, obviously more than ever, because now it's costing us our freedom.
Right.
Well, you better damn well be able to show that that thing really is a thing.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Well, and I want to note too, just if, for those that watch the round table, Mikovits is clear that she thinks that this hasn't, that you agreeing on the fact that it hasn't been isolated in regard to SARS-CoV-2, but yet that she'll argue that there has been with HIV. And to your point that it just seems like a constant moving of the goalpost, which works with the whole COVID discussion, where you say this is how you isolated, and then it can't happen with this one instance. And so we go, oh, well, this is what we did instead. So you can, I mean, this is the same thing with COVID-19. You know, it's if you didn't meet what you set as the gold standard, you can't call it that. But this is happening on a large scale. And it appears to me, based on what you're saying, it's been happening for quite a long time. So either there was something they were looking at or they were wrong a long time ago. In any case, they're no longer meeting what they say they're supposed to, which seems to lend credence to what you're arguing, right? So before we get into the discussion of that, I want to talk more about the concept of this in the context of COVID-19 and how can somebody, first of all, like a Dr. Mikovits in these positions, let's say somebody who believes they're doing this, end up thinking that they're actually doing this? Like, you know, that's the argument can't be that every single person in these fields are dishonest. It certainly could be. I shouldn't say it like that. It's certainly possible, but it doesn't seem likely. So, you know, the people out there that are doing this on a daily basis, are they just deceived? Do they not understand what's happening? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, this is a kind of a really challenging question to answer because it's not just virologists. You have this widely represented, you know, probably throughout our society, but I can speak most about in healthcare. So, you know, think about oncologists. Every day they're giving, you know, extremely toxic poison to people and hastening their deaths, right? And that's the reality of the situation. And they actually know it, because when you do surveys of oncologists, would you give chemotherapy to your own family? They say no, 90% of the time, more than that, I think. So they know it's poison. They know it's not good, yet they continue to make a living doling it out, right? So how do they reconcile it? There are different psychological mechanisms, you know, like denial and justification and things like that. But this is, you know, a major conflict that many people are living with. And usually what you do is you just ignore it. You don't think about it. You know, and when reminders of it come up, you just, you know, you have a way of filing them away or, you know, saying they're an anomaly or, you know, whatever it is. And people are afraid to shed true light on this situation because they have to acknowledge their own shadow. And, you know, I had to go through this as well. Like when my kids were younger, I vaccinated them, right? I had them injected with poison. And I can't take that back. And I had to go through a process to forgive myself and, you know, be more vigilant in the, you know, looking ahead so that I don't make the same mistakes again. But it's really, really difficult to reach that point and allow yourself to be honest and to take responsibility and, you know, recognize that you may have made some very serious mistakes. You know, you may have even killed people.
Yeah, this speaks to the whole larger idea of the social engineering and that I touch on all the time. And it's not just about health or COVID. I mean, it speaks to the larger idea of some multifaceted agendas, large, powerful people abusing people beneath them to achieve whatever they want. And it's historically speaking constant, right? And so we recognize that this is definitely happening to a degree. You see it with policemen, you see it with military, you know, people get, you know, rebuilt essentially. And so I've seen plenty of documentaries of people coming out and saying, you know, in medical school, this is what they teach you. You know, it's like, I remember what it used to be like. And now it's basically like, you know, this is what's happening. You give them this pill and, you know, which is a wild oversimplification, but at the end of the day, we've seen that tailored change, which is it's interesting. And a lot of people, even in regard to being wrong today with any number of topics, you're right. People would rather put their head down, not accept it, and just listen to the person telling them what they want to hear and go, oh, I was right. Good. I'm not that bad guy that I think I might be. You know, it's easy to fall into that. And they want that.
And, you know, Ryan, it's interesting. There's a similarity between the different professions and careers that you mentioned, like military and law enforcement and medicine, is that they all go through hazing rituals. Like medical school is a big hazing ritual. I mean, I've been, you know, threatened. I've seen surgeons throw scalpels at people, wow. Right? I mean, you get, if you don't answer the right question, you get cut out of things. And, you know, there's all this kind of trauma programming. You have to, you know, consume so much material that you don't have time to sleep or, you know,
or think about it. That's what I always point out is you're just memorizing stuff, digesting, analyzing. You know,
there's no discussion groups where they debate the merits of this or that paper or theory. There's nothing. I mean, maybe some of that comes later here and there, but mostly they just pay lip service to that. And yeah, you memorize all of these, you know, concepts and regurgitate them back. And if you don't, we'll whip you, you know, you'll fail. And it's funny because, you know, like think about the type of student that gets into medical school. It's very competitive, right? These people are straight A students. They never failed a test. They never failed a class in their life. And then what happens in medical school? They actually fail them. They make them take things over, repeat stuff, right? For very minor reasons. And it's part of the trauma because when people in fear, they are much, much easier to condition, right? This is proven experimentally time and time again. And this is what happened with the masks, for example, and social distancing is that first the announcement of, you know, millions are going to die. We need to lock in the intense fear. And then, you know, the fear bred the conditioning, you know, wear your mask and you're a good person. You're protecting the community. Don't wear it. You're a psychopath, right? There's the punishment, the negative.
Literal arguments made for sociopath, psychopath on multiple mainstream outlets. That's just unreal. Yes, you know, absolutely. But yet we can't point to actual science and make a different argument. It's just
I look at that as pure. This is behavioral conditioning.
Yeah.
And it's done, you know, in a purposeful way because you know that the media outlets that put out these articles are all owned by a couple of people who are the same people behind the global agenda.
Right.
So, you know, this is a very well coordinated, you know, sort of psychological operation. I think that's the best term for it.
Yeah. Yeah. The coordination is something I've been really trying to point out, such as seeing the World Economic Forum tweet and then delete their argument that lockdowns are good for climate change. And then we see The Guardian do the exact same thing as if that, you know, oops, our bad. We didn't want you to think about that being a possibility. You know, it's just, there's definitely a coordination here. And, you know, I think you and I should definitely revisit and have a show about talking about other things than this topic, because, you know, it'd just be really interesting because I think we have a lot of similar mindsets on these things.
Absolutely. But
bringing this back into the discussion of the isolation, and before we jump over to terrain in general, I just want to point out to Kaufman's point is this is the basic definition, and one of the few that you find that actually has the variant between like social isolation, and which is odd, by the way, seeing as how relevant it is today. Call me a conspiracy theorist. I tend to find those things intentional, but it says pure microbial strain that has been separated from a mixed laboratory culture. That's the important part. Go ahead if you want to say something about that.
Well, it's interesting that it says from a mixed laboratory culture and not from a clinical sample. Because like if you, let's say you had a strep throat, a throat culture for, you know, strep throat, they would take it from your throat and they would then, you know, basically just grow it to see clones, but it's not from a culture, it's from your throat. Right. Sample. So it's kind of interesting that they would put that there.
Which, and then this is the point I made before about being the isolation versus the whole idea of Koch postulates, because like to your point, it has to be specifically from the individual, from a healthy individual. Like that's what it states, both the re-isolation as well.
You know, a microbe that's isolated could be isolated from any source, really, right? You can take it from a mixed culture. You could take it from a cave. You could take it from someone's snot. Right. It doesn't matter. The process is to separate it out. And make it pure. So that's really the important. I just think it's interesting that they put from a certain source, because the virus isolation experiments do use a mixed laboratory culture. But they don't get purify anything from it though. they keep it all mixed together.
If anybody out there thinks for 1 second that there is not active reworking of these things, I mean, look to the WHO and the herd immunity definition that everybody caught, right? They didn't want it to be public, but they changed it. They knowably changed, they removed the concept that you could have herd immunity from anything other than a vaccine and stated that exactly. And then we got called out for it. They quietly changed it back, right? Right now they're actively trying to change these things, and that just screams dishonesty. Now here's another.
Herd immunity is also a theory.
Right. Well, I see this is the argument underneath the discussion of the train theory. All these things would be right. Everything that ties back to the concept of a virus would be in question under the belief of the train theory, which I do want to talk about once we get past these articles, because that's the thing. That's the big difference for a lot of people is, you know, they can't get past that concept, right? Because that they've been linked, which is, I think, in a dishonest way in and of itself, that you can have the discussion about there are two different things, even though they are obviously related. And I know that's what you're thinking right now. You can have the two different discussions of something in regard to Koch postulates by itself, and then address the concept of whether the entire paradigm is wrong, you know, but there, and they should be done in two separate conversations, I would argue, you know?
Well, yeah, because you know, you can only talk about a specific instance really with Koch's postulates. But if you talk about the summary of all studies for, you know, has Koch's postulates been done successfully for any microorganism? Well, that leads you to the paradigm.
Right, exactly. Right. One leads to the other. And see, if you start with these things don't exist, most people that are still buying the mainstream narrative are going to immediately check out. And that's sort of the point, is about showing them, first of all, well, look, if they're not even meeting this basic definition that they're claiming they need to, recognize that, and then let's discuss why that's not happening, right? And that leads into the bigger discussion, you know? I wanted to point out on this before I go to these actual studies, is the idea that it says here in the same concept, and this is what I find odd in regard to Wikipedia, which is constantly being updated and edited, it just leaves out the entire idea. It says primary isolate is a pure microbial or viral sample that's been obtained from an infected individual rather than in a laboratory. So what are your thoughts on
that? So I think this is an excellent definition, and that is what it should be, right? Because that's the real definition. So it's a pure microbial or viral sample. So in other words, all you see is one microbe or one virus and nothing else when you look on a microscope slide, because it's pure. And then it's been obtained from an infected individual, right? So in other words, a person who had the illness that may be caused by a virus, you isolate that pure virus directly from that infected person. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying is how you show that a virus exists and may be related to an illness.
So the term pure, you argue, is sufficient. That's stated exactly the way it should be.
Yeah, well, pure is, you know, never corrupted in meaning in any scientific publications that I'm aware of. It's just this word isolation that they seem to have a different definition of in virology. But, you know, I think it'd be hard to misconstrue pure, because pure means free of contaminants. Yep. And anything other than a virus in a sample of a virus would be a contaminant. So it would have to be purified out or removed.
Interesting. Yeah. See, I was sort of thinking in the other direction, but that makes sense, right? I mean, it's simple. It's exact. I was thinking the idea that they made it more broad, but yes, exactly. You're right. Now that you think about it, pure microbial or viral sample. So that's suggesting that it has nothing else along with it.
This is a term that David Crowe really promoted, because he felt it was also less ambiguous. And then like the work of, I think it's Christine Massey, who really collated all of these freedom of information requests from governments around the world, asking for evidence that they have of an actual purified virus particle. And they all, of course, had no information on it. It's actually, I think that's very powerful information. You know, why is it that no government has been able to respond to a properly worded freedom of information request and provide evidence of this virus being even existing?
Well, that's what's interesting on that note, is that you've probably seen as well that the UK, what the MRHA, I believe, they responded in an email stating that it was a computer model as opposed to the isolate, but they used the genetic sequence that was given to them. So that's an interesting point that we keep seeing, that even a Moderna claims to have gotten the sample from China and 2 days later already had a vaccine being tested. I just don't even see how that's possible. Maybe you can speak to those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what I really think is going on here is that we're actually moving towards a new type of proof for the existence of viruses that's even easier to do than this isolation experiment. And I'll explain why. So the tissue culture experiment that they say proves a virus, that they call virus isolation, is also the same exact way that they make a traditional vaccine for a virus. So in other words, they have a foreign cell culture. They add the material from a clinical sample, like a sick person's sputum with an illness. They culture that with other toxic chemicals and calf serum and things like biological materials like that. And then it becomes, the cells die because it's a toxic soup. And they take the liquid off that, filter it, and then put it in a syringe. And that's a vaccine. It's called, that's in a live virus vaccine, what they call. So essentially, they had the same experiment for discovery and drug development. But that was a process that took 10 years or more to actually have, because they would actually do it slightly more complicated. They would take that liquid and put it into another culture and then another culture and, filter it a few times and do different things and then add different things and then do clinical, laboratory studies with animals and such. And if it was toxic, they had to go back to the drawing board and make it more dilute, this kind of thing. Now, with where they're at now is, now we have these new experiments which weren't available in the 1950s based on genetics, where they make this theoretical computer genetic sequence, right, called an in silico genome. And it's completely fabricated. It's not, taken from an intact virus where they pull out the genetic material and they sequence it. It's taken from millions, and I mean literally millions, of fragments found in someone's lung fluid. And then they just assume which ones are from a brand new organism that's never existed, and then have a computer assemble them and say that's the genome sequence. But the reason why this is so powerful is because with the genetic vaccines, the different companies have a platform, right? Which basically goes in a syringe and it can deliver genetic material to human cells and make it the cells produce whatever product is coded in that genetic material. And so, with Johnson & Johnson, it's DNA based with an adenovirus based platform. With Moderna and Pfizer, it's mRNA based, a slightly different kind of genetic material that has to be preserved at super cool temperatures. So it's less convenient, but it has, I think, a plasmid platform that, so you basically just pop it in. So here's how it goes. There's a rumor of a new disease. Some laboratory takes some kind of tissue fluid from the person with that disease, and they only need one single person. One person. That's all they need to do this. That's how it was done with SARS-CoV-2 the first time, just one person. So they take their sample, they put it through this process called next generation sequencing, and the computer modeling is called alignment. And it only, they can do this in a matter of days. And the computer spits out a theoretical sequence of a theoretical new virus. And it maybe says it's similar to something else in the database, but it only has to be marginally similar for them to associate it. And then boom, they just take out what they think is a gene, send that code through email to Moderna or Pfizer. They program it into their RNA synthesizer machine. And hours later, that sequence comes out and then they pop it in their platform and boom, they're ready for clinical trials.
Okay, we just hit on something really big, I think. So what you just described, so remembering that Moderna in 2 days had this thing up and running, what you're saying is that they decided to use this new thing, this new style of doing things during a surprise pandemic, The biggest pandemic in a century, they say. How, first of all, does that seems quite telling, right? Why would they choose to use something that hadn't been done before for the first time during this if they hadn't planned to do this, especially since it seems that Moderna clearly had their platform set up because they gave them the email and 2 days later they were up and running. So what does that tell you right there? That seems to suggest it was planned in some degree, does it not?
Yeah, well, these platforms that I mentioned, these were already developed and ready to go. Not by just one company, but by all these different companies. So that when the time is right, it becomes like a plug and play.
Right. Well, it should be stated that that's for basically that they've been building and working on these things publicly in regard to mRNA coronavirus vaccines before this. So it makes sense that they would have something, but the idea that they would roll this out in a way for the first time sort of publicly during what's happening does not make sense to me. Like from a scientific perspective or a medical perspective.
Yeah. Well, this is a business strategy, not a scientific perspective. And, you know, it has other purposes as well, you know, more esoteric purposes. But, you know, with Moderna, it's actually quite interesting because they had the platform, but they had not been really developing vaccines. They were developing cancer treatments using the same platform. And of course, they call it gene therapy in cancer, which is what it is. It's not a vaccine.
But fake news.
right, exactly. And this is the first time that they actually ever have a product approved and ever making actual money for selling something, not just being given investments.
Right, despite having a wildly high evaluation before this, again, which speaks to the fact that they knew this was set up, that this was happening, this was going to happen. I didn't call it, but Moderna was going to be one of the main ones picked the moment this started, because I just simply noted, oh, look, all these people that have financial ties, the NIH, Moncef Salawi, like it's a no-brainer in my opinion that would be the one that would be used. So if you know that this is going to be set up, and yes, I'm speaking hypothetically here, and you know, for people out there listening, this is my opinion. If this was already set up and the platform was enabled, they knew this was going to be the setup, and they knew that people would be, I mean, the people that were involved with it obviously knew, because there seems like there was some kind of a profit motive there. It just, again, I know it seems abstract, but I think at the end of the day, there's no way that this could have been set up the way it was, and they wouldn't have taken the actions they did if they didn't know that this was already in effect, which seems to suggest foreknowledge of the larger event. Talking about Event 201, it seems like it's an obvious thing, but.
Well, this strategy is really lends itself to being done in a pinch, because, you know, the old recipe, it's kind of like making a soup. You know, you want to make the perfect soup. Soups have tons of ingredients, right? And you can play with each ingredient and, you know, hundreds of times before you get it just right. And that just takes a little time. And that's what took, you know, 10 years for the previous type of vaccine development and testing. But with this, like you said, because you have this plug and play platform, all you need is that email with the sequence, or it gets posted on the database and you download it. You can then have your machines making that sequence molecule in hours and have something ready for testing. And because the platform is already known, you've done all the testing in advance on the platform. So when you do it, when you plug in that gene, you already know half of what you're going to expect, and you've worked everything out ahead of time. So it's basically you're just doing it again, you know, by plugging in this gene and then by this gene. And then this is really the coup de grace, which is that because this is set up in the terms of a pandemic, which is an emergency, you don't need to actually get approval from the FDA or whatever government agency. And it's really important, because I've seen this misquoted in the New York Times and other sources. None of these gene therapy vaccine products have been approved by the FDA or any other agency. They've been given authorization for emergency use only.
Right.
Right. So that means they don't actually have to prove that they're safe and effective. And if you look at the letter that granting this authorization, you'll see that that's exactly what they say. They say, we think it might be, it's reasonable to believe it could be safe and effective, but that's all they can say, because they haven't done the testing and proven anything, right? So this allows you to get it to market in no time at all. And of course, in this situation, you have the other benefits of no liability at all, complete immunity, and free marketing. Because who is doing all the marketing for you? The government. So, you know, you have, it's just a windfall for all of these companies, to, and they have this technology ready to go, and they can do this over and over. They could do it twice a year.
They're already floating this right now, actually. It's been the last couple of days. One of the big pushes has been, you know, rushing the modified vaccines because of the variants, right? So now we need to get this moving faster so we can just plug in the new variant. And 2 days later, we've got the new vaccine. So you can come get your next one 2 days later. That's kind of the idea, is that you'll just right. keep getting them over and over and over.
Yes.
It is definitely a windfall for sure.
And I can tell you what a variant is because it's very simple. So remember I described how they have a computer theoretically developing that genome sequence from just one person. Mm-hmm. Well, when they get the second person that they do the same thing, well, guess what? They're not going to come up with exactly the same sequence because it's made up. So they see that they come up with something close because they instruct the computer to make it a certain size and look for certain sequences. And so they make it close, but not quite. And they say, oh, here is a variant or a mutation of the virus. It's so dangerous. This variant could be more dangerous than the other one. And so if you look on the GizAid website, you'll see that there are hundreds and hundreds of these things. And all it means is that they cannot replicate the experiment with the same results more than once. And every time they don't get the same results, they say it's a variant.
And they're just starting to give them names that make like the one there's a new quote devil variant in California. It's just like, it's just so apparent on its face that they're trying to do this to scare people. Even by the way, as you probably know as well, even the groups involved with this, such as NervTag in the UK, or I believe even the WHO said, look, based on the evidence we have, there's no evidence this is more dangerous, more transmit, but they did it anyway. They continued lockdowns. They put people on, it's all based on fear and erring on the side of keeping control. Yet when it comes to the other, as we talked about before, they'll err on the side of the same thing, control, even when it's a contradiction of their stance. Now, I want to bring this into the discussion of the larger theory that you have, because it all leads that direction, right? This is a very important discussion to have. But before we do that, I just want to point out again, back to this thing that, as your point before, it states grown in a laboratory, which then means by definition, it didn't meet Koch's postulates in regard to the larger discussion. But I wanted to go through these with you real quick. First of all, because this is what the people would argue from the outside position, as you mentioned a moment ago. Well, this study says right in the title that it's been isolated. So starting with the CDC document or the page, it says SARS-CoV-2, the virus. Make sure you guys can see the screen. That might help. SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, was isolated in the laboratory and is available for research by the scientific and medical community. Now, down here, this is probably what you'll be able to point out. This is their timeline of how they walk through this. January 20th, received a clinical specimen collected from the first reported U.S. patient infected with SARS-CoV-2. CDC immediately placed the specimen into a cell culture to grow a sufficient amount of virus for study. February 2nd, CDC generated enough grown in the cell culture to distribute to medical and scientific researchers. What it already seems like right there, that didn't seem to apply to the full discussion. But then it says February 4th, they shipped it to resource repositories. So what are your thoughts on this page and why they're saying that it's been isolated?
Well, you know, this is really just repeating the same thing that all the other papers say. And, you know, that's why we created the statement on virus isolation. And in the bottom of that, and it's a short statement, but it gives some instructions on, you know, what do you do when someone sends you a paper? And what you should do is look at the methods section. And so that's not an actual paper from the CDC, but it says enough because it says that they took a clinical specimen and grew it in a tissue culture. So right there, that tells you that it's not a real true isolation experiment, because they would have to isolate it directly from the clinical specimen to show that it exists. And once they show it exists, well, then they can try to culture it in a tissue culture, because they could then isolate particles out of that culture and compare it back to what they took out of the person and say, is it the same thing? And then that might tell them something. But we know that tissue cultures break down and have their own particles. This has been known, you know, since 1950s. And even in Ender's paper, they said that the monkey's kidney cells themselves have virus particles. So even if it really was a virus, how do you know it didn't come from the monkey?
Right.
It's not from the clinical sample. So that's the problem right there. And that's the answer it gives you.
Right. And this comes back to the same point of these, you know, would you do me a favor and walk through Koch's postulates? Not in the, you know, just tell people in your layman's terms what it means, the four steps. It's just because I brought it up and I forgot to go through that for people that are listening on the podcast as well. So what is Koch's postulates in four steps, and explain what that means essentially?
Yeah, sure. And this is really, it is quite common sense. So I'll just break it down simply. So, but I just want to clarify that before you get to Koch's postulates, first you have to actually have a microorganism, mm-hmm. right? So it's all predicated that there's a germ, you know, a microorganism that causes a disease. So first you have to actually have a microorganism that you think causes the disease that you've shown actually exists. So if we say, you know, that it's Streptococcus bacteria, for example, we know that exists, right? You can easily find it in nature. You can show it in a pure form in the laboratory, and it has certain features. Okay, so we need to do that. But Koch's postulates is a way to say that something that's known actually causes a disease, and it's a way to prove that. And it's very simple. So it says that you can actually find that microorganism in people with the disease. Of course, right? How could they have the disease caused by it if it's not there?
Right.
But also that it shouldn't be in people who don't have the disease. And this is a major problem we have with the current situation, because, you know, if you think the PCR test actually measures anything real, well, we have it being positive in people that have no symptoms who are healthy. So that doesn't really make sense.
Or in a Kiwi tested by Dr. Scoglio. Right. I mean, all yes. kinds of examples of this being ridiculous. Well, I also add to that the idea, yes, they keep trying to push the concept of this asymptomatic transmission, but there's been more than one study, including of over 10 million people, that stated that it was basically non-existent. So I would argue that that also suggests either the false positive or that it's being found in healthy people, either way you look at it.
See, Ryan, this is why it's so important to understand that there's no virus, because if there's no virus, how could you transmit anything from person to person?
Right.
You don't need to do a study because you know you can't, because there's nothing to transmit. Right. So back to Koch's postulate. So after you say that, well, you can find this thing in people with the illness and not in healthy people, well, then you have to be able to take it out of those person with the illness, because that's really the only way you can show that it was in them in the first place, right? Now, this part about a pure culture only applies to bacteria, because viruses aren't really organisms that can exist by themselves, if they exist at all, so they can't grow by themselves. But you still have to isolate it from a diseased organism, and that's the part that's not been done. Then right. after that, you can grow in culture.
Koch's postulates applies to any microbial that might be causing something, not just virus. Okay, that's important to state for people that didn't know that.
Right, and there's a famous virologist known by the name of Rivers, and he wrote actually a way to modify these for viruses. It's a little bit more complex than what's here, but basically it's essentially the same. And the papers that I mentioned before, they use the Rivers, you know, quote unquote modifications, but it doesn't change the overall logic of it. It's only subtle changes, because viruses can't do certain things like grow in a pure culture, but you still have to take it out of the diseased organism and isolate it. Then after you do that and show that it exists, then you can grow it in a tissue culture and see if you can make it increase. Like, that's perfectly reasonable once you show it exists, but you can't do that and say that shows that it exists. That's the big problem. So, but we're really getting to the money here, because once you actually have the purified thing to show that it causes a disease, what you have to do is put it in a healthy host.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the same disease would manifest in the healthy host. And I'd say you don't even need the fourth step, okay, which is to then re-isolate it from that host that you made sick. But you do have to show that that healthy organism you put it into has to develop the same disease, not a different disease.
Okay. Right. Which you would argue, and I think, which hasn't happened. The argument is they've just simply taken laboratory cultures or genetic sequences on a computer and stated that that's the isolation.
Well, they've taken a variety of toxic materials, like, for example, chopped up brains and spinal cords from children that died of polio that they didn't purify. They just took that chopped up dead brain material and put it into, ejected it straight into monkeys' brains. And the monkeys got very sick, and they said that that proved polio. Right. Or they've taken, as like the experiments that I described earlier with the SARS-CoV-2, they just took the toxic cell culture fluid and they put it into actually transgenic mice, not even normal mice, but genetically modified mice. And those mice had bristled fur. Okay. Not coughing and shortness of breath and fever. They had bristled fur. So, you know, that's not the same illness. It's not even the same organ system.
Right.
Right. And so
where everything under the sun is now indicative of COVID-19, and that makes that solution, that problem go away, right?
Well, yes, but I've still never seen bristled fur being one of the reported symptoms in humans.
Right. Right. But it works that way just because it's something different. We noticed a variation, so it exists. But this is the kind of, you know, but see, this is what bothers me about this, is the people that make that argument must know that what they're doing is wrong. And you could argue that they're doing it, you know, I just don't see how somebody could make that statement right there. No, and not be doing it in a dishonest fashion. You know, and this is what frustrates me, is that begins to paint this picture of an entire cultivated industry of people that are just willing to be dishonest for whatever reason, you know, and I don't like to think that, you know.
You know, I had, you know, I've actually published some articles in scientific papers, and I've gone through peer review, and I've actually been a peer reviewer for a few papers also. And, you know, I had really good teachers, and they whipped me into shape. Like, I would write up my research and they would fill it with red, and I'd have to basically rewrite the whole thing. Sure. Because they wanted to make sure that every single thing I wrote actually matched up with the science and the statistics of the data that we're looking at, right? And it's just astonishing to me when I read these papers that, like with these Koch's postulate papers, it's every single step of what they did was wrong. Every single piece of observation that they interpreted was wrong. It was quite astonishing, like, to see that, and this passed peer review and actually got published in Nature, one of the, you know, most prestigious and difficult to publish in journals. And then on the other hand, you have the Danish mask study, for example, which followed the standard high quality randomized control trial protocol. It was a very straightforward, simple design, powered appropriately, and they couldn't get published.
That speaks volumes to where we are right now.
Because it didn't fit the narrative, you know, right. Dangerous virus need mask, you know, it's because it concluded that masks had no effect.
And I'd also point out that the CDC, and this is actually post the May 2020 meta-analysis, I don't know why that one's no longer relevant. It's literally the most important part of it. But after that, they said, we're going to do more meta-analysis because the one we just did didn't get the answer we liked. And they got a lot of different people doing these meta-analysis, and this is from the CDC website where they list all the different ones, but the ones they post in the discussion, you'll find omit certain ones. And if you look at those ones, you find they're the ones that challenge the narrative, even in small ways. Talk about cherry picking, you know, and it's like, it just choose the ones they want to show you.
I have, you know, this is not a new tactic. If you go back a few years, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology put out a position paper on home births. And what they did is two things. They put out two papers. One was a meta-analysis, and the other was their position paper saying, you know, home births are dangerous. In the meta-analysis, they included, because there are tons of large studies in this, like in Europe, where they've studied hundreds of thousands of births. And then they have all these awesome studies, and I knew the studies already because I did home births because they're so safe. And what they did in the analysis is they omitted like 1.5 million data points and only included like 5,000. And they were like high risk pregnancies or something, or it was skewed data. And it basically said what they wanted in the conclusion. But if you didn't read the methods section, you'd never known that they threw out 90% of the data and didn't put it in the meta-analysis. Right. So this is just, you know, sleight of hand, really. And it's amazing that the gatekeepers let it through, but they do time and again when it supports a certain agenda. In that case, it was, if you have a home birth, then the doctors don't make any money.
Right.
Outside of their system.
And this is shown throughout history, at this country alone, but plenty of other places. For so many times, it's very frustrating that people can't reflect on this today, such as the entire Reefer Madness fiasco, which is so embarrassing now, because that was a legitimate documentary when it came out. Now it's in the comedy section, or it used to be when there's video stores, you know, and it's there's a lot of examples like that. And one of which I always point out, Ben Swan did an entire discussion on Kratom, for instance, and walk through these. This is very relevant to today. The FDA was involved, and the FDA was stating these people died from kratom. And you just barely scratch past the surface. One of these people literally died from a shotgun wound to the chest. And because he had kratom in his system, they said, well, that's a kratom death. That seems exactly what's happening with COVID-19 in the same way. And that's just dishonest. There's no variation there. That is lying to meet an agenda. That's what's happening today.
Well, you know, they make a lot of money selling opiates, and right. It's huge business. And, you know, clearly it's part of a bigger agenda because it's a major cause of death. And there's no denying that, you know, and
it's worse during the pandemic. It's gotten exponentially worse, and suddenly they don't care again. I don't think they ever really did.
No, there's actually a study on that, which just looks at the number of emergency department visits for overdoses on opioids, and it has increased quite substantially in the last year since the pandemic.
Damn. Yeah. I mean, there's 1,000 examples of stuff just like that that are showing us that these, in many ways, are the wrong steps to be taken. Now, I figure, since it's basically the same argument, I argue with these other studies, but for the same point, just in case you had any comments on them, because like, as we said before, these are what people would send and say, see, they're claiming that it was isolated because it says it right there. Genome sequence obtained from several acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2 strain isolated from the esophagus swab specimen? Is that what that stands for? The oral?
Yeah. No, it just means, you know, your mouth and throat.
Mouth. Okay. And basically, so what are your comments on this in general? Is there anything that stands out to you in this specific study?
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, first of all, the fact that it says a complete genome sequence is really a lie. Mm-hmm. Because this is a theoretical genome, not a complete by any means. And even in some of the other papers, they admit that it's may not be complete. And then it's from also like a single patient.
Right.
Right. So one 32-year-old man, and, you know, who has a cough, mild fever, and throat congestion. So not even someone who is on death's door. And then they, you know, this is the most complicated type of paper to read, because there's a lot of trickery going on with the genetic manipulation that they use. And I actually recently gave a talk trying to break this down. And we're working on a addendum to the virus isolation statement talking about the in silico genome. But essentially what they do is they just take this sample of this man's, you know, saliva or a specimen from his throat, and it has tons and tons of RNA in there. And, you know, if you scroll down, it might even say how many reads there were on the sequencing. But if you can find where it says the number of reads, in one other paper, it was over 56 million. So those are individual strands of RNA. And what they do is put that in a computer and have them match up overlaps of those strands. And they get these things called contigs, which are contiguous sequences, but they're of different lengths. And they usually from about 200 long till somewhere around 30,000 long. And so basically out of 56 million strands, a computer pieces these together in some way like a puzzle. But there's no way to know if any of these overlaps or strands are accurate, because there's no nothing to compare it to. Like if we did this and we wanted to reconstruct the human chromosome out of this 56 million pieces of RNA, we would have the computer do this, but then we would compare it to the actual human chromosome, which we know what it is because we took it right out of a human and we sequenced it from one end to the other. Mm-hmm. Right. And then we can say, okay, we've got, you know, 80% of the sequences here, and then we can map them on something known and say, we're missing these ones. Right. But we can't do that with something that is previously unknown. Like SARS-CoV-2 has never been isolated. Right. So that they've never actually shown the genome of it. So how do they compare these, you know, subset of 56 million fragments? What is it? Like, how do they know it's right? They can't compare it and say it's right, right? So there's no way to know what they got. And so really what they're doing is just completely junk. It's completely conjecture.
Which, yeah, I mean, that speaks to all the other discussions we're having here, that this is it's arguable that they know that they're sort of taking a roundabout way and avoiding the way it's supposed to be done. And that's become acceptable in these circles. And so it happens nonetheless.
Right. Well, here's an example of what they do, right? So like in one of the other studies in Nature, the first study that was done on SARS-CoV-2 with the in silico genome, they got all the sequences, right? All the reads, the 56.5 million, and they used two different pieces of software. Right. They used the software A and software B, and they didn't like software A, but they liked software B. So they took the result from software B. But how do they know that software A wasn't correct? Right. And also, by the way, you know how many different solutions came out of the software? Like a million different solutions. So how do you pick which of the million is the right one? Right. So you can see it's complete BS. And I hate to use, you know, crass terminology like that, but it's ridiculous. It's completely made up and has no meaning in terms of describing an actual thing in nature.
Is there any connection between that thought line and the one of the recent studies that came out in regard to the PCR test, where they're saying that there was a huge scandal? Well, not really. It should have been a huge scandal where they found out that they were only using like one, I believe they were saying a genome from the sequence, but there were supposed to be at least three of them, if I'm remembering that correctly. I may be using the wrong terminology, but you know what I'm talking about? There was the
study. Well, this was a trick used to supposedly show the presence of a variant, but it actually just made a bunch of negative samples become positive samples. The thing is, right from the beginning, that's why you need to look at this issue, because when you understand that there is no virus, well, then you know that there's no test for a virus. So you understand that anything they're doing is just manipulating a test to give fake results, and they're using that for a hidden purpose. And then if you realize that, you can actually develop true understanding about what's going on. And it's also quite easy to make decisions for you and your family, because if there's a test that is not measuring anything related to your health, why would you ever participate with it? And if there's a treatment that's related to a non-existent threat to your survival, then clearly you wouldn't accept it, because there's nothing to accept a treatment for. And that's why, you know, looking at this, while it may be challenging to understand some of the scientific concepts, really, if you break it down, you know, like Tom Cowan is the most gifted at explaining it in simpler terms by using analogies, but everyone can understand this. And once you understand it, everything else becomes very, very easy to understand. You don't have to worry if are there excess deaths or no excess deaths, because if there are, you have to then, what's the real cause? It's not a virus. And if there aren't, then you say, okay, whew, everything is status quo. But I'd say, you know, if there are, most likely, well, it's because of suicides and lockdowns and putting people on ventilators who aren't sick and putting people in nursing homes who are sick. And, you know, and those are reasonable explanations, and you can easily solve those problems by simply changing some policies. So it really actually simplifies understanding every aspect of the pandemic situation if you look at this fundamental claim.
Well, and to add to that, before we get into the terrain theory itself, it's one of the things that I've been saying, even for those that don't agree with that concept, is it's becoming quite clear that if you just start breaking these things down mathematically, it almost seems impossible that there could be something more happening, because you have, these are things we know. We know that there's a high false positive rate that is being, that is just not being addressed on the PCR test as well as the antigen test. You know, we know that there are the conflation of the pneumonia, influenza, and COVID numbers on the CDC website. Right. So you start taking these things off. You start chipping away all of the pneumonia and flu that shouldn't have been lumped together. You take away all the PCR positives that should have, or, you know, that should have been negatives. You know, you begin to recognize that there's really not much happening there. You add the nursing home. Right. If you have 50% of the deaths in this whole country coming from one location, you know that it's not ultimately what it seems like, right? But each one of those by themselves, you could see as a, you know, a caveat. But when you add it together, I don't see how it's possible this can even be present to that argument, right? Because these numbers basically add up to what we're being told is the information there. But also on top of that, you have the mask being added to this discussion, and how I am very certain, based on basic information that you can see, that the mask is creating a level of illness as well that's also being diagnosed as COVID-19, bacterial pneumonia, or, you know, all these different things that can be caused and are being caused to some degree, in my opinion, by this mask wearing. So just all these together, you see all these different reasons why these numbers are bloated, is my point.
Like, it's so complicated to come to these conclusions because the numbers are being used to support opposing conclusions. Like, for example, right, you may say that masks are increasing illness, but the official narrative is, you know, that COVID cases are increasing, or there's a variant strain that's more transmissible. Just like when we might recognize increased deaths from vaccines, whereas they're actually called deaths from COVID. Like one nursing home, the explanation for the 24 people who died within 2 weeks of the vaccine was that a super spreader came into the facility and everyone got COVID. So you can just conflate and confound the issue by taking the same data set and giving opposite interpretations. And, you know, just like a paper trying to explain the, is there excess mortality or not? Like there was a paper put out a month ago by James DeMayo. It's 40 pages long. He needs 40 pages to explain, and it's still controversial because people who have read it still say that they disagree that there was excess mortality, right? So when you get into the volume of argument and research that's required to wade through, you know, this, all the subterfuge, all of the propaganda, the false reporting, the false death certificates, you know, all these things, you can really get lost and get confused and overwhelmed. But if you realize, hey, they didn't actually show a virus, and you could in about 1 hour arrive at that realization, then everything else makes total sense. You say, oh my gosh, wow. Well, if there are people dying, it's not from a virus. There's no reason to wear masks. There's no reason for all of this. So why is the government doing it? What are they really trying to do? How are people misinterpreting this? And you can, now maybe you don't have the answers to all those questions, but if it comes up, you know, do I do this for my family? Well, no, of course not. Am I going to vaccinate my family? No way. Because there's no virus to vaccinate against. I don't have to think about it one bit further beyond that.
There's one thing that I always tell people in regard to larger events of the past. Take 9/11, for example, that JFK is an obvious example going back a long way that I don't think we'll ever fully know, as a matter of fact, what happened. But what we do know is that we were lied to. Right there, we can establish that we're being lied to right now. So whether we ever fully understand the depth to which they're deceiving us, as long as we all agree that we're being deceived by our government, we can actually make something happen there, you know, and that's what I want people to focus on. Or even back to the mask point, it's like, you know, yes, they're saying it's something else, but that point applies no matter what they're saying, right? The idea that whether that is causing the COVID infection or it's causing something else, it's just a choice that was made that obviously leads to more problems rather than solutions, just like lockdowns, just like all of this stuff. So it begins to paint this picture of what does seem to be an orchestrated event to some degree, whether it was used, that it happened, or they made it. I mean, again, this gets into these discussions where people go, oh, conspiracy theory, and they just check out. But historically speaking, there's a lot of reason to think these things may actually be happening just like this. such as, you know, NSA spying on us fluoride in your water. You know, these things are very real that used to be conspiracy theory, but go ahead.
Well, I would just say that, you know, anyone who has lived through the last year and is still would turn away from someone that, and label them as a conspiracy theorist, they're not willing to look at the reality of what's going on in the world.
Right. Critical thinkers.
How could this not be a conspiracy, which simply means that two or more parties acted in concert? Right. Because when have you ever seen almost every nation in the world adopt the same exact policies?
Yes, that's
that never point. Happens. We've faced other crises, and you know, look how long it takes to get people to agree, and they agree on very, very minimal. Here, they're willing to change, you know, everything about how they run their society, including shut down their entire business sector. You know, so there's obviously a conspiracy, and there are documents after documents that it's written about in, from the Rockefeller Institute, from Johns Hopkins and Event 201 people, from the United Nations, from the Bilderberg Group. You know, there's, you know, one after the other. So it's obvious it was planned, and it's obviously that it's a conspiracy.
And the only reason I agree completely. And the only reason I even bring up those other examples is just to show that we have a history of our government not only being caught for doing the things they say they aren't doing, but the very people who are saying just there's not true, you crazy conspiracy theorists, later turn out to be the very person who's in the crux of the illusion, you know. And we need to be able to reflect on that. Now, you had a comment you were going to make about this page in general and in regard to the interesting variations here in compared to what we were talking about before. And then I want to jump into train theory and just kind of wrap up on what that is and why, you know, just give your explanation to people about why you think this is what's happening and why we're being deceived.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, so terrain theory is really not foreign to people as it may sound, but it is really the exact opposite of germ theory. You know, germs were originally found after the microscope, and the word germ itself means new life or new growth. And so it was an inversion of meaning to say that it's an agent of disease. But what happened is they just saw under the microscope that when they looked at animals' tissue that had illness, they saw bacteria there. And they got the idea to blame the bacteria for causing the illness and not realizing that actually bacteria are everywhere and they have a role to clean up the environment when things are damaged or dead, which is called their saprophytic function or their saprophytes. And so terrain theory just looks at that model, and it's based actually on experimental evidence by some scientists who were really kind of the foes in a way of some of the germ theory scientists. And I'm talking about like the rivalry between Antoine Béchamp and Louis Pasteur. Mm. But fast forward to 2021, we all know about terrain theory already because we know about the microbiome. And that's really what terrain theory is. And from the microbiome, what we know is that there not only do the bacteria and microorganisms in our body outnumber our own cells by some estimates 10 to 1, like 10 bacteria cells for every one human cell in our body. But we know we actually can't survive without these bacteria and other microorganisms like fungi. And in fact, we've even found that they, in their DNA, the gut bacteria DNA has been found in cells in our own brain, in our own brain cells. And so they play a really, really important role in our body's functioning. And terrain theory just says that microorganisms are not the cause of disease, but they actually help us heal from disease. And that they live in our body and actually are generated from our body. And that by a process that's related to pleomorphism, we could get into if you want. But that the cause of disease is something else, and that the bacteria and other microorganisms actually help us heal from disease.
So how was this theory proven or shown to be the case, you know, by the people that believed it was the case when it first came into being?
Well, you know, the first experiments were really interesting, where and they used fermentation as a model for infection. Okay, so they, you know, they called an acute disease like strep throat or a cold, you know, say that's an infection that they were studying, but they were using fermentation as a model. And fermentation is the process, you know, that we make beer and wine,
right?
Where microorganisms like a yeast turn plant sugar into alcohol, or, you know, maybe to invert sugar, things like that through fermentation. And so there were these experiments first, where it seemed like the microorganism had to come from the air and mix with the sugar in order to ferment it. But, and that's what Pasteur really exploited, that experiment. He went down to all the, like, the south of France to these famous vineyards and, like, made a whole public relations spectacle when he did this experiment, taking the air from the vineyards. But Bechamp later repeated these experiments in a closed system. So nothing from the outside could get in, and the microorganisms generated from inside the dead material. Sure. And this was a major revelation. And then later on the microscope, they were able to show, like in blood cells, for example, that you can see these tiny specks coming out of blood cells and that they change shape into different bacteria and fungi. And these are basically what happens is that your body has an insult somewhere, that's there's some disease, like some tissue is poisoned, for example. And then there's some kind of signal mechanism that calls on your body to evolve the right species of microorganism to clean up that area. And that's why, you know, when you have, for example, a sore throat, you can find Streptococcus predominantly, because that's probably the right species to clean up whatever debris is left in your throat area after an insult. And so that's like the healing phase. And that's when you have the symptoms, and the bacteria are actually do produce the symptoms, but that's blamed as being the disease when it's really the healing.
Okay. Right? So, the question, I guess, would be then, how do you explain the people that would get that and then it just continues to get worse unless there's a treatment? Strep is a good example. And it's weird because all this is really ringing true with the whole mass discussion, even the fermentation, the oral thrush.
This is the perfect thing, because I can explain how these things work. So essentially what it says then is the health of the organism depends on the health of the terrain. So if you have the right environment, raw materials, you know, think about a forest that's really healthy versus a landfill, which is really unhealthy, right? That's bad terrain is the landfill and good terrain is the healthy forest. So in your body, if you have healthy terrain, you know, which means proper nutrition, free of poison, free of psychological distress, etc., then everything works fine and you're healthy. But when something damages the terrain, then you have this response. Now, in some of these conditions that you mentioned, and like thrush is a good one to mention, and also like C. diff, if you ever heard of that, is another good one to mention, or you have recurrent problem, like the problem goes away and comes back. So usually these are because of pharmaceuticals. And so what happens is, you let's say it's like recurrent ear infections for kids, for example. So there's some insult to the ear that causes a problem at first. It could be a bunch of things. Maybe it's actually a heavy metal from a vaccine, or maybe it's a medication, or maybe it's some chemical in a processed food, or maybe it's a parasite, whatever it is.
Industrial disease, right?
Yeah, right. Industrial pollutants, you know, air pollution, what all these kind of things, right? So something gets in there, causes the problem. Then the bacteria come to clean up the damaged debris and restore healing. But that gets diagnosed as the infection itself, and then they take antibiotics. Now, antibiotics not only kill the bacteria that are trying to clean up the ear, but they kill other normal ones in different parts of the body that are doing other good functions. So there's collateral damage.
Right, chemo the same way, where you're just kind of like carpet bombing your body, killing everything.
Chemo, the most toxic, you know, things that you put in, that basically it's as toxic it could be without killing you outright.
I just recognize the interesting correlation between the way that they're going about it, right? It's like, well, we'll just use this thing that kills all of it instead of like recognizing that, you know, you might want to not hurt your body while trying to heal your body. It's interesting.
Now, so sometimes what happens is that antibiotic will just, you know, kill everything. It'll arrest the healing process, but the symptoms will go away because the bacteria cause the tissue swelling and stuff that makes you uncomfortable. But the healing is interrupted. So then what happens is, well, a couple months later, then you have another ear infection. And they keep coming back because they never get complete healing. Now, also, even worse, what could happen is that you give a really toxic antibiotic. Maybe after a couple of times it comes back, the doctor gives a stronger one. Now you've damaged the terrain for the bacteria. And maybe the bacteria then change their phenotype, their behavior to become aggressive.
Interesting.
Whereas it's only because you actually damage their terrain, now they're unhealthy, right? And then they cause a problem. And that, of course, can always be brought back into balance. But that's what you have with things like thrush from antibiotic use, or you have like C. diff colitis, which can be lethal. You know, for people that have had antibiotics destroy the bacteria in their colon, and then these ones that are normally there, Clostridium difficile, right? It's there normally in balance. Now it's been damaged, its environment, so it basically goes into a survival mode, which means it's hostile to your body now. Whereas that's not its natural state. It's only because we've poisoned it and we've turned it into that, like we've created kind of a Frankenstein.
Right.
So it's not in the bacteria's nature to do that. It's normally just, you know, getting along with everyone else. But, you know, just think about what happens if we, you know, cut off your food supply. You're going to start getting ornery and you're going to thinking about breaking into your neighbor's house and stealing their food, right?
Or better yet, your body will start consuming itself at some point.
That can be part of a healing process too, but you're right. It's called autophagy. But you know, I'm just kind of highlighting that it's really only when we add insult to injury that we get in this situation where the same microorganisms that are their natural state is to support our life function and help us heal, they can occasionally turn into a problem themselves. But only after we really push it.
Right. And that, which is clearly where we are right now in the society. So basically what you're saying under this theory is that any issues we're having are caused by external factors, right? Whatever that may be. And then essentially the way that we're trying to deal with them are only exacerbating the problem. But so in the context of COVID-19 and the whole discussion, essentially it's because of the buildup of all these problems, whether it's past vaccines, pollution, all these different concepts. And we're then pointing to what is happening and saying that's COVID-19. And it's just a roundabout continuous cycle. Now, do you think that there are people that are aware of this at the top, or are there people, this is your opinion, obviously, or are they just bought into the narrative of what they think they know?
Well, I mean, the people at the top who are calling the shots, yeah, they know this all too well. And in fact, this is why, you know, certain prominent people, they don't even use Western medicine, you know, like the royal family in England, they go to homeopaths because they know. And I've actually even known one or two natural healing consultant people who have worked with some of the, you know, elite families. They're well aware of all this. You know, I mean, this may not be 100% verified, but Bill Gates' personal family physician, you know, reported that he didn't vaccinate his own children. You know, of course not.
The Rockefeller's family, literally, when American Medical Association and the Flexner Report, that whole big shift in American medicine where they just made it all about pharmaceuticals and oil-based drugs, it was shown well after that, after they went around and basically made sure all these homeopaths and all these different doctors were shut down, that he went on to use his own homeopath for his family for well after that. This seems to paint a picture of an orchestrated choice that was made a long time ago that's continued to this day. And I think what we have to recognize is, even if it is that kind of long-term idea, that you have just new generations that pop up within this, even arguably part of that problem that will not know that they're wrong about something like that. You know, it's really interesting. And it goes back to the idea of how are the sciences done? The funding comes through these channels where people are driven into these certain ideas. It's just really interesting. And, you know, the idea that it is being caused by all these other factors speaks to why they wouldn't want us to be aware of this stuff, because it will lead back to things that are being done to our detriment, like pollution.
I mean, Ryan, how many doctors do you think know how it's proven that a virus has come about and causes disease? You know, there almost none. Mm-hmm. It's never taught. They just don't know that. Like, I mean, I think most people assume they do, but no, they're just told, just like everyone else, that viruses cause these disease. They couldn't even describe any of the experiments that are used to show this, you know, whatsoever. You know, this is something that you have to really look at. So most people, as you know, are completely ignorant. You know, they think that they're doing the right thing in many cases, but they've never really looked at, well, what is the really evidence for this? You know, I never checked it out. I was always told it. I believed it. It seemed to be true, but I never really looked.
They were always taught to trust the authorities above them, like everybody else. And that's this whole cycle. They're just trusting the CDC says it. Well, I know they wouldn't lie, 'cause I was taught that in school. You know, let's leave it on this right here. If you were to right now, what would you do if you had all the resources at your disposal and everything you needed? What would you do to prove to somebody that terrain theory was the truth? What would you have to do that if that's possible?
Well, you know, it's really hard to prove things to people when they're not willing to look at, yes, you know, new ideas. So I don't think there's really any amount of money that can overcome that for most people, but I actually really do have a vision to answer this question, which is I have a vision of an opportunity for a total, you know, redo of the healthcare system. And I would essentially really throw out the entire current thing, not all of the medical science necessarily, because there are some things that are really of high value, like, for example, how to, you know, reconstruct deformities, right? Or, you know, how to reattach a finger, things like that, right? That has obviously clear value, mm-hmm, right? But I would take it out of the system and the culture and the business model, which is highly toxic and profit driven and has different motives. And you could remake, you know, healthcare in a way where people are responsible for their own care, and you would need much, much less of a system. It would be very, very inexpensive, but you could essentially do all kinds of really fascinating research because one of the main problems with assuming this false germ theory and virus dogma is that it prevents you from looking at the true causes of illness. Right now, I know from experience and from many others' experience that there are a few categories of things that really make people sick, like, you know, toxins and poisons, for example. But we don't really know the exact mechanism that these things, you know, cause specific diseases. We don't know which ones cause which things or what's the best way to deal with this one or that one. So we could do all kinds of really important research to uncover the truths about these things so that we can figure out how to help people like completely heal, like be cured from these conditions, not just live, you know, with it by taking a drug for the rest of their life, you know, like real healing. And if we do this in a way where it's in, you know, the public good and let people research what they're passionate about and make sure that we all share information so that we don't, you know, contradict each other and do unnecessary duplication, but we validate each other and support each other's research into like a whole body of knowledge, like, you know, and you'd have to organize it in a totally different structure, not this pyramidal hierarchical type structure.
Right.
But, you know, one that has, you know, everyone's on the same level and it's like a lateral structure that's integrated, you know, where we're all working in parallel under our own sort of sovereign direction. But we communicate with each other and collaborate and say, hey, you know, we want to learn about this, but it's too big for our small group. Let's, combine efforts and, you know, see if we can do this big thing. And we're always going to gear it towards, we want to help people. We want to answer important questions and we want to satisfy the curiosity of the human condition.
Yeah. And it's important that it's public and transparent and that people can look at it. Right. I mean, that's the problem with today is there's so much that's just sort of couched in different areas where you can't, you know, or even the way that I mean, I've watched the CDC literally reorganize its website since this, where it's like impossible to find things. And there's a reason that's being done.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's frustrating. I mean,
this could be like a totally open source distributed network kind of thing where you put data out there and then three people can independently analyze that in different ways and compare the results and the validity to each other. And, you know, like it could be so powerful if it was just out there for everyone to be able to see and use and contribute to.
Yes. And it would show people that there is another way to do this. And we don't necessarily need the control, the guidance of some kind of, as you put, hierarchical structure, some government, some big pharma influencer, right? It's clear that if it's left to, I mean, this is the problem with what we've gotten today, is they're telling people that, well, you're just not smart enough to understand it. So listen to your betters, right? That's the idea, that you don't do your own research. I couldn't believe I'm seeing these on Forbes and New York Times. New York Times headline was literally, critical thinking is not helping you. That was actually what they said. It's just, this is what they're driving toward. And what you're saying is it's exactly what we need. It's something where everyone can look at it. You can dive through for yourself. You can learn about things. You know, it's incredibly important. This topic is something that I'm still very interested in. And, you know, I want to see this more fleshed out, because there's no reason anybody should be reflexively dismissive about something that might change the way you understand things, you know, flat earth to where we are today. Like, things evolve, you know, it's important to understand. And if you came out with something tomorrow that says, wait a minute, it's actually not round, it's square, here's the data, I'd be like, well, let me see it. You know, it's like, we want to understand where things are going. And to leave it at the point in regard to the terrain theory, I think it's interesting to recognize that the way that's laid out is ultimately, without the other problems, without the vaccine issues and the disease, the pollution, that the argument would be that strep would heal you, or rather that the bacteria would heal you. And the only reason that you're not able to heal yourself is because of the manipulations of people that are hurting you and the planet around you. That seems pretty spot on to where we are right now. So
I think that's a great way to describe it, Ryan.
Yeah, well, it's just frustrating how obvious all this stuff is, you know. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me again. And I'd love to have you back on in the future as this does develop, as hopefully your project continues to grow. Anything else you want to leave us with before we go?
No, just to say thank you again for, you know, giving a platform for this important perspective. And, it's really the fact that you, you know, take this seriously and put this information out there is, really important. So, appreciate the opportunity and definitely come on again.
Oh, my pleasure, Dr. Kaufman. Yeah, it's always great to have you on. I hope you guys all will take this to heart, research the information, dive into the source material and think for yourselves. And as always, question everything, come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.